This is Digital Story Podcast number 1028, December 2nd, 2025. Today's theme is catching up on the latest photo news. I'm Derek Story. We've been so busy with workshops and gift guides that I haven't been able to share the latest interesting news stories in our space. Well, that changes today. I have the DP Review Camera of the Year, the Leica Photo of the Year, and the scoop on what really killed Minolta. All of that and more on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, what a time it is right now with the Black Friday stuff and Cyber Monday and all those good things. And there have been a few good deals on the Inner Circle. We have a thread going of people sharing some of the things that they found out there. But all of that is fun. But sometimes we just need to get back to good old basics. What is going on in our world of photography? And that's what we're going to focus on today. And we're going to start out with a piece that's on DP Review. And it's their 2025 Product of the Year. Now, they have all sorts of different categories, and they're fun. And I have the link in the show notes, as you may imagine. But I want to focus on the 2025 Product of the Year because I think it's a very interesting choice. Now, what they came up with, the contestants were, right, the finalists were, the Canon EOS R6 Mark III, the Hasselblad X2D II 100C, the Nikon Z5 Mark II, the Panasonic S1 Mark II, and the Sigma 17-40mm f1.8 DC art lens. So those are our five contestants, our five nominees, our short list, as they like to put it. I'll start out giving you the honorable mention, and then we will go to the actual Product of the Year. So the honorable mention went to the Sigma 17-40 f1.8 DC art lens. And here's what they said. We've always appreciated the work that Sigma's done to let APS-C shooters get the most out of their cameras. And for a long time, the high point of that was the company's madly ambitious 18-35mm f1.8 art lens from 2013. It was a huge step up compared to an f2.8 zoom, but without being an unreasonable size or price. There was just the slight downside that DSLRs had tremendous difficulty focusing it, especially with off-center AF points. We weren't surprised when it developed a second career as an adapted lens for video on mirrorless cameras. 12 years later, and mirrorless is well enough established for Sigma to release a successor, the 17-40mm f1.8 DC art, an updated version that stretches a touch wider, reaches a little further without spoiling the original concept. It's still sensibly small, still usably light, and still aggressively priced. It's appreciably less expensive in real terms than the original. The difference is it focuses really well on every format Sigma's been allowed to release it for. So Fujifilm, Sony, and Canon APS-C users suddenly get the option to expand their camera's capabilities. That was the runner-up, and let me find the price for you right here. And it looks like the basic price for the Sigma 17-40 is going to be right around $920. All right, so that was the runner-up. So who won, right? Who won DP Review's Product of the Year? It was the Nikon Z5 Mark II. And they are very, very high on this camera. Let's hear what they have to say. This year has seen the release of some excellent mid-price full-framers with the Panasonic S1 Mark II and the Canon EOS R6 Mark III, both raising the level of what can be expected from cameras in their class. But it's the more humble Nikon Z5 II that stood out to us more because, while it's not quite as fast as the more expensive models and can't match them for video specs, it comes surprisingly close. The Z5 Mark II launched for $1,700 and is now selling for less than that, outperforms the Z6 Mark II, which was Nikon's mid-range model until late last year. Unlike its predecessor, it's adept at both stills and video shooting. Unlike Canon's EOS R8, it offers in-body image stabilization. The ergonomics and handling are transposed almost directly from Nikon's other models, and there are no blatant segmentation plays such as imposing a smaller battery. With Nikon's latest AF system, it's a hugely capable all-arounder, and as we said in our review, very few of us truly need anything more. And currently, the price for it looks to be right around $1,596. That's just the body. But that is an excellent full-frame camera for that price. And it is DP Review's Product of the Year. The Leica Picture of the Year 2025. Joel Meyerowitz's street photography masterpiece captures the magic of New York. And you can find the link to this article on Digital Camera World on our show notes. Let's read what Digital Camera World has to say. Leica has just announced its Picture of the Year 2025, celebrating a timeless moment of street photography from one of the genre's greatest innovators. The winning image, Puerto Rican Day Parade, Manhattan, New York City, 1963, by Joel Meyerowitz, distills everything we love about Leica's legacy. Spontaneity, color, and the ability to catch life exactly as it unfolds. This year's selection places Meyerowitz, a member of the Leica Hall of Fame since 2016, along icons such as Ralph Gibson and Thomas Hopker. Captured at the fringes of New York's famous Puerto Rican Day Parade in 1963, the photograph shows four impeccably dressed women gathered in a Fifth Avenue doorway, touching up their makeup. It's a scene overflowing with life, color, and the unspoken choreography of the street, the kind Meyerowitz has spent a lifetime mastering. The image, Puerto Rican Day Parade, Manhattan, New York City, 1963, speaks to perception, timing, and confidence, qualities that have defined great street photography since the earliest days. Quote, "I used the parades as a way to overcome my shyness, because people in the crowd were absorbed by the passing show in the street. I could slip in under their gaze like a plane flying too low to be picked up on radar," Meyerowitz remembers. "They were about the heat of the moment." Since 1959, Puerto Rican Day Parade has been one of New York's most vibrant celebrations, an expression of self-confidence and celebration of Puerto Rico's rich culture and history, particularly for the millions of people of Puerto Rico descent living across the United States. Meyerowitz's photo captures that exact spirit. Amid the parade's bustle, he remains invisible, responding instinctively to what he describes as a flood of impressions. Born in 1938, Meyerowitz has been one of America's most influential photographers since the 1960s. His embrace of color as a design element reshaped the very language of street photography. It was precisely 90 minutes that prompted his life-changing decision after watching Robert Frank move through the streets with a Leica, gliding with ease. Meyerowitz quit his advertising job the same day and threw himself into the exhilarating world of street photography. His Leica M2 soon became his trusted companion, sharpening his instinct as he chased the tension and everyday magic of life. Now, they have a limited edition print of this, and it's not too terribly bad. By the way, you can see the picture, as you know, in the show notes. You just click on the link there, and it'll take you right to the page on Digital Camera World, and the picture's there. The picture's pretty much all over the place right now, and I think it's an excellent choice. I love, love, love the shot. It has a sort of a West Side Story feel to it. Anyway, the limited edition print. The Leica Picture of the Year 2025 is available exclusively through the 27 Leica galleries worldwide, continuing the brand's tradition of offering collectors the chance to own a curated, museum-grade piece of photographic history. There are 81 prints available, 15.75 by 19.69 inches, includes signature label, edition number, authenticity certificate, and presentation folder. The price is $1,454, and it will be available from December 2025. Boy, wouldn't it be cool to have that print hanging in your living room or your studio or your den or your office? All right. Okay, last thing about this. The Leica Picture of the Year isn't simply an annual honor. It stands as a curated tribute to the photographers who shaped the brand's visual legacy. Since 2021, Leica has chosen one Hall of Fame photographer each year, offering us a chance to own a part of Leica history. Congratulations to Joel. I mean, fantastic picture, fantastic career, and I certainly wouldn't mind this shot hanging here in my studio. What really killed Minolta? A postmortem. And this is an article on fstoppers.com. I have a link to it in the show notes. For those of you who shot film in the days of film, Minolta was a big deal. They were one of the most innovative camera companies. And now they're gone. So what happened? Well, this article actually digs into it a bit. And I thought it was really interesting. I was a big fan of some of Minolta's cameras. Let's see what F-Stoppers has to say about this. Before the big two dominated professional photography, there was a big five. Canon, Nikon, Pentax, Olympus, and Minolta all competed for market share in the film era, and among them, Minolta wasn't just a player. They were arguably the most innovative of the entire pack. And I would say arguably because I think Olympus is right there with them. But that's just me. This was the company that gave us the Minolta Maxim 7000 in 1985, the first mass-produced 35mm SLR with fully integrated autofocus and motorized film advance that literally created the modern camera market as we know it. This was the company that introduced the world's first sensor-based image stabilization system with the Diamage A1 in 2003, what they called anti-shake, years before in-body stabilization became an industry standard. They collaborated with Leica on the legendary CL, developed advanced metering systems, and pushed the entire industry forward and consistently delivered optical quality that rivaled anyone in the business. So what happened? How does a company that invented the modern autofocus camera and IBIS simply vanish from the face of the earth? The common narrative you'll hear is that Minolta was slow to embrace digital and got left behind in the transition from film. The reality is far more complex and far more tragic. Minolta's death was a slow spiral that began with a catastrophic, industry-shaking lawsuit in 1992, was complicated by a desperate merger that solved nothing, and was finally ended by the company's complete inability to compete in a technological war they could no longer afford to fight. The slow move to digital wasn't the cause of Minolta's death. It was a symptom of a mortal wound inflicted more than a decade earlier. So what was that mortal wound? Well, it was the 1992 Honeywell lawsuit. If you want to understand what really killed Minolta, you need to go back to 1992. This is the inciting incident, the catastrophic event that crippled the company long before digital photography became a serious threat. The Minolta Maxim 7000 had revolutionized the camera industry in 1985, bringing reliable integrated autofocus to the masses and forcing every other manufacturer to play catch up. But there was a problem. Honeywell, a U.S. technology conglomerate, claimed that Minolta had stolen its patented autofocus technology to create the Maxim system. They sued, and in 1992, a jury sided with Honeywell. The judgment was staggering. A jury awarded Honeywell $96.3 million, and the case was then settled for $127.5 million, including interest. To put that in perspective, adjusted for inflation, that's nearly a quarter billion in 2025 money. This wasn't a fine or a slap on the wrist. This was a corporate execution. That single payment severely constrained Minolta's research and development capacity throughout the 1990s, the exact decade when every other camera manufacturer was pouring billions of dollars into the single most important transition in the history of photography, the move to digital. While Canon was developing the EOS D2000 and later the 1D, while Nikon was creating the D1 and building out its professional digital ecosystem, Minolta was trying to recover from a financial catastrophe that had crippled its ability to compete. The death spiral, trying to compete with a broken leg. Here's where mythology around Minolta's demise really falls apart. The conventional wisdom is that Minolta was slow to embrace digital photography, that they were complacent or stuck in the film era, while nimbler competitors raced ahead. But the truth is that Minolta was not slow to try. They released digital cameras relatively early, including models like the RD-175 in 1995. The problem wasn't lack of effort or vision. The problem was that they simply couldn't compete. By the time they launched their first mainstream A-mount DSLR, the Maxim 7D, in late 2004, Canon and Nikon had already built out complete professional DSLR lineups and established themselves as the only serious choices for working pros. The 7D and its sibling, the 5D, released in 2005, were good cameras that featured Minolta's innovative anti-shake technology, but they arrived years too late to change the narrative. They were bringing a knife to a gunfight that they used to own. The end of the line, the 2006 sale to Sony. By 2006, there were no more cards to play. On January 19, 2006, Konica Minolta announced they were ceasing all camera and photo operations, shocking the photography world and leaving countless loyal Minolta shooters wondering what would happen to their lens investments and camera systems. But here's a detail that makes the story even more complex. Konica Minolta, as a corporation, didn't die. The 2000 merger was just two drowning camera companies. It was a merger of two massive, diversified Japanese corporations whose business interests went far beyond photography. Both Konica and Minolta had large, highly profitable divisions in office equipment, copiers, multifunction printers, medical imaging systems, scanners, and optical components. When Konica Minolta Holdings announced it was exiting cameras, it wasn't a bankruptcy filing. It was a cold strategic business decision to amputate the underperforming, low-margin camera division and focus resources on their highly profitable B2B and medical imaging businesses. The camera and photo businesses together had posted losses of roughly 8.7 billion yen in the prior fiscal year. Today, Konica Minolta is a multi-billion dollar multinational corporation that simply doesn't sell consumer cameras anymore. The camera division wasn't the whole company. It was just a disease limb that the parent company cut off to save the rest of its body. But here's where the story gets fascinating. Minolta didn't just die, it was bought. And the buyer was Sony, a consumer electronics giant with deep expertise in professional video and broadcast equipment, but no heritage in professional still camera systems. What did Sony actually purchase when they bought Minolta's camera division? They got the A-mount, the autofocus lens mount that traced its lineage directly back to the revolutionary Maxim system. They got all of Minolta's anti-shake patents and the engineering expertise behind sensor shift image stabilization. They got Minolta's entire catalog of legendary lens designs and decades of optical engineering knowledge. And most importantly, they got a foundation to enter the camera market without having to build everything from scratch. Sony's Alpha line was born directly from Minolta's corpse. The early Sony Alpha DSLRs were essentially Minolta cameras with Sony branding and electronics. The A-mount lived on. The sensor stabilization technology that Minolta pioneered became a cornerstone of Sony's marketing. And as Sony eventually pivoted to mirrorless and created the revolutionary A7 series, that same Minolta-developed IBIS technology became one of the key features that made Sony's full-frame mirrorless cameras so competitive against Canon and Nikon. Today, cameras like the Sony a7 IV, the company's most popular all-around full-frame mirrorless body, feature in-body image stabilization that is a direct descendant of Minolta's anti-shake system, allowing photographers to shoot handheld in low light with any lens. Even Sony's flagship A1 Mark II, capable of shooting 50 megapixel images at 30 frames per second, is built on the foundation that started with the A-mount and IBIS technology Sony acquired from Minolta. The next time you pick up a Sony mirrorless camera and marvel at its class-leading sensor shift stabilization, the next time you see a Sony shooter using a Minolta A-mount lens via an adapter, you're looking at the ghost of Minolta. The name is gone from camera bodies and lens barrels, but the spirit of innovation that made Minolta great, the engineering excellence that gave us the first mass-produced integrated autofocus SLR and the first sensor-based image stabilization lives on in the company that bought its legacy. Minolta may have lost the war, but their innovations won the future. Great piece, don't you think? Now, I didn't read all of it. There is even more detail in there. So if you want to read the entire history, which I just think is absolutely fascinating, then just go to the link in the show notes on the F-Stoppers article, and you can get all the details. But what a story, and what a wonderful rebirth for Minolta. Too bad it had to go that way, though, right? I have one last story for you, and this is kind of interesting as well. We're still sticking with history here. 113 years ago, the U.S. tried to outlaw fake photographs. This is an article on Petapixel, and I have the link in the show notes. It's easy to imagine that anxiety over manipulated images began with Photoshop or AI. But photographers have been wrestling with the problem since the birth of the medium. More than a century ago, 113 years to be exact, the U.S. faced a scandal over doctored images of the president, and the outrage nearly led to a national ban on fake photos. In 1912, a U.S. senator actually introduced a bill named, in his words, to prohibit the making, showing, or distributing of fraudulent photographs. According to the fascinating piece by Freethink, which first surfaced this long-forgotten legislative attempt at regulating analog image manipulation. There's a long history of fake photography. Victorian photography was full of visual trickery. Headless portraits and spirit photographs were created with double exposures and other stage marvels, fascinating viewers, and fooled many of them. These techniques were considered clever at the time, but they also laid groundwork for distrust. Eventually, retouching soon became routine in portrait studios, where photographers reshaped faces or softened features by working directly on negatives or glass plates. By the turn of the 20th century, Freethink notes that photography was starting not to be seen as a trusted or neutral medium. In 1897, the New York Tribune bluntly declared the long-held idea that photographs do not lie had collapsed. The paper warned that the rise of retouching via the skillful work of the negative meant photography was now made to suit the fancy of the ordinary vein. When a fake presidential photo pushed Washington too far. By 1911, photo fakery had reached the nation's capital. Small shops in Washington, D.C. began selling novelty prints that placed tourists beside the then U.S. President William Taft. The images were initially harmless souvenirs, but federal officials took notice. A U.S. attorney ordered the businesses to cease the practice, and a subsequent request to continue, submitted to the White House, was denied. But the mounting pressure ultimately forced the novelty photo operation to shut down. The situation took a darker turn the following year. Authorities discovered a small doctored Taft portrait in the possession of a man wanted for human trafficking. Reports said that he used the manufactured presidential photo to win the confidence of his victims, and suddenly fake images became a national concern. The Justice Department drafted legislation to outlaw fake photos, and Senator Henry Cabot Lodge agreed to carry it forward after allegedly seeing a doctored photo of himself with someone he had never met. On July 29, 1912, Senator Lodge introduced a bill that would make it a crime to create or distribute any fraudulent or untrue photograph or picture purporting to be a photograph without the approval of the person depicted. Punishments could reach 6 months in jails or fines up to $1,000, which is roughly $31,800 today. The debate over fake photographs intensified just 2 months before the 1912 presidential election. On September 8th, the New York Tribune ran a series of humorous but entirely fabricated images under the headline, "The Race for the White House." The photographs showed the three main candidates riding the animals associated with their parties. William Howard Taft on an elephant, Woodrow Wilson on a donkey, and Theodore Roosevelt on a moose. All three images were fakes created by the photographic firm Underwood & Underwood, highlighting to the public just how easily photographs could be manipulated. Ultimately, the 1912 bill to ban fake photographs went nowhere and was never passed. However, the proposal's existence shows just how old and how familiar concerns about fake photographs really are. Oh my gosh. You know, that's the magic of history, isn't it? The things that you think are just today, not so much. Let's take care of a little Virtual Camera Club news. I want to start out with what we talked about last week, which is workshops. We have our 2026 TDS Photography Workshop season posted, and there's a link in the show notes, or just go to nimblephotographer.com and click on workshops. We're featuring webinars, online workshops, and in-person events focused on creating impactful images in the company of those who love photography as much as you do. Our workshops are like no others, and we think you will thoroughly enjoy the camaraderie and the tips and techniques. All you have to do is go to thenimblephotographer.com. We still have some workshops open. Two have already sold out, but we have lots of stuff available for you, including webinars online and still two in-person workshops with seats open. So I would get over there as soon as possible, and I hope you'll join us in 2026. Rob Knight and I have a great season planned for you, and we'd love for you to be a part of it. I want to give a big thank you to our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that support this community month in and month out. Many of our workshops are filled with Inner Circle members, and especially Inner Circle Bold members, who receive perks such as being able to attend the webinars for free, one selected online workshop for free, and then a 10% discount on everything else, including the in-person events. That's just one of the perks of being an Inner Circle member. And if you want to get active with our photography community in 2026, becoming an Inner Circle member will save you lots of money. In order to join us, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there, and then the next thing you know, you'll be hearing from me with goodies in your inbox. And a big thanks to Inner Circle members for supporting this show. And finally, I'd like to give a huge shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story, the folks that this time of year that can help us create some of the most unusual and creative gifts that people will receive. Red River Paper shows you how to make all these things: calendars, fine art greeting cards, beautiful black and white prints, colorful landscapes. They have tutorials on all of that. They have a great selection of paper, and they will help you choose the right paper for the project you're working on, and they're there to help you if you need it. All you have to do is click on the Red River Paper tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. I'll take you to our landing page. Note the discount code, because that will get you free shipping for your order. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting our podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe, See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.